Welcome to Ludlow. Ah, there's nothing quite like being in a forest, surrounded by majestic trees, a gentle breeze, and the sound of nature singing its glorious daily chorus. Welcome to Ludlow, the home of the Tuart trees. Nestled between State Forest 1 and 2, the Ludlow Mill and Settlement is rich with stories of hopes and dreams, discovery, and, like many places, crime and tragedy. On this very spot, early settlers forged a life from themselves the only way they knew how, with grit and determination. You're standing at the heart of one of the rarest forests on earth, the home of the Tuart tree. This little slice of rare earth is the only place in the world that the Tuart tree grew naturally. A gift of nature. The Wurundjeri people nurtured the Tuart forest for many years, and it thrived. It's with gratitude that we pay our respects to them for their care of this special place. Unfortunately, with colonization in the early 1800s, the wood of the Tuart tree offered greater value to human endeavors when it was cut down. Now, nature itself has created an environment that inhibits the Tuart tree from self-seeding and thriving. And so, the Tuart tree is listed as critically endangered. We believe that with help, this forest could thrive again. If that's important to you too, then please lend a hand. If you're interested in learning more about Ludlow, its history and purpose over time, please visit our District Office Discovery Centre. It's time to begin your walk. Now please move over to the Limestone Walk Trail and our first story post. You'll see it on the edge of the car park and pine tree forest to the west of this building. This music is your cue to pause the story until you arrive at the story post. Ludlow, let's begin our journey in the early 1830s with the story of how Ludlow got its name. Frederick Ludlow and his wife, Mildred, or Kitty as she preferred, emigrated from Ireland to Western Australia in 1828. Originally servants of the Curry family and then the Molloys in Augusta, Frederick Ludlow was known for his addiction to alcohol and, according to Georgiana Molloy, the mistreatment of his wife. After Kitty's death, Frederick moved to Vass and worked for the Bussell family. One of his duties included overland journeys to Perth for supplies. It's believed that on one of those trips in 1834, Frederick returned to the Bussell farm and told John Bussell of the small river he'd crossed on his journey northwest of the farm. And so it was, Frederick Ludlow was given naming rights and the Ludlow River and area of Ludlow were recorded in history. In 1836, this majestic forest was described by Captain Bunbury as a fine open forest with a good deal of grass growing under the very large white gums called tuats. It was idyllic and peaceful for all who passed through it. Soon, Captain Stirling was to lay claim to large tracts of land in this district, and the early settlers took advantage of government schemes to acquire the remaining land to carve out their farms and create a new life for themselves. Much of this land was along the coast and on the banks of the Ludlow River. You are standing on what was surveyed as Location 19 in the Sussex District. Originally owned by the McGlashan family, this site has changed ownership a few times before it became a significant part of the history of forestry in Western Australia. In 1908, the Forest Department had begun to acquire land in the area. The progressive forest policy that influenced decisions at the time advised the protection and management of the indigenous trees and the cultivation of a soft wood industry was a priority. To the east of Ludlow, cleaning and grubbing began on approximately 57 acres of land so that the pine trials for future plantations could begin. Different varieties of pine trees were planted and monitored to determine the best variety to thrive in our soils. And that turned out to be the Pinaster pine. This site at the junction of the Ludlow Bridge soon became a hub and a home for the foresters who managed the forests and the new plantations, the pine plantations, in the surrounding districts. Now, before you head off along the limestone path, notice the couple of large eucalypt trees on the edge of this path close to this story post. These are tuart trees, or Eucalyptus gomphocephala. They're some of the very few left standing on the settlement site. These giants are characterized by a soft grey-coloured, shallow grooved bark and elongated, pointy green leaves. See if you can spot any more on your walk. Now please continue along the limestone path to the left of the toilet block and follow it as it sweeps to the right along the back of the fence line. Please pause with this music and then press play when you reach the next story post. Nursery and Gantry. An early 1900s sketch reveals the original plans for this site, and interestingly, it shows a very detailed planting scheme for the trees that were to be established here. It's believed that some of these plantings may have been experimental in nature, as many of the trees are not indigenous to the area. Featuring mainly a mixture of eucalypt varieties and various types of conifers or pines, you can still see some remain where they were planted over 100 years ago. Look out for these along the walk trail. Peer through the fence now and look towards the right. Do you see the clear top building with the whitish shade cloth over it? This was the original forestry nursery. Built in the early 1960s, it was in this small space that Dr. McKinnell experimented with tip grafting, which resulted in the evolution of a faster-growing and much straighter Pinaster pine tree. This variety was to become the favoured pine to be planted in the sandy soils of the southwest. There aren't many pine plantations left, unfortunately, but you'll be able to see some examples of the Pinaster pine here at the settlement. Restored in 2022, thanks to a grant from Lotteries West, the nursery continues to thrive under the care of our landscaping group. Fire, every forest and every forester's nightmare. Look through the fence towards the left for the A-framed log structure, the gantry. Built in the 1960s, its purpose was to load two large square tanks of water suspended at a height that was just above the flatbed of a blitz truck. When the fire siren sounded, both of the 600-gallon tanks were lowered quickly onto the truck beds and driven away at speed to the firefront. It was all hands on deck as the foresters pivoted into their firefighter role and their families waited anxiously at the settlement, praying for the safe return of the men. Adjacent is the long wooden-clad machinery shed containing several vehicle bays. This 1950s building housed the various trucks and large vehicles needed for forestry work. Peppermint Avenue and the Forestry School. You may notice that you've just walked through an avenue of peppermint trees. Like sentries, they line the road that once led from the old forestry school to the horse stables. These trees were planted over 100 years ago. Looking over the story post and to the right of the green building, about 100 metres in front of you, is an historically significant site. This is the place where the first WA Forestry School for Forester Education was opened in 1921 by the conservator of forests, Charles Lane Poole. Charles was a visionary leader who convinced a previously resistant government that our forests needed management and care. In 1918, the Forest Act that he wrote was passed. And then, here at Ludlow in 1919, Charles declared the first two state forests of Western Australia. Only 2 years later, he opened the School for Forester Education. It was a turning point in West Australian history, as the government soon realised the potential of managing our forests. 24 apprentices began their education at the forestry school in 1921, and many successful foresters graduated from the school before it closed in 1927. The U-shaped forestry school was also a place to call home for the students and the caretakers who looked after them. Imagine a vegetable garden and a tennis court right near where the old building stood. You can still see the cement flooring of the old wash house. The oval was positioned in front of the school and was used daily for football and exercise. Unfortunately, the forestry school burned down in 1979. But up until then, it was being used as a football camp for boys. The green building to the left is destined to become a forest education centre. As you continue to walk along the limestone path leading towards the back corner of our lease, you'll pass a prehistoric-looking pine tree on your right. Native to Queensland, this beauty is the bunya pine tree. Interesting fact, the seed pods of the bunya pine tree grow to the size of footballs and can weigh up to 10 kilograms. I wouldn't want to be standing under one if it dropped one of those. It's a wonderful specimen, but not one that would have worked in our pine milling industry. Trial Pines and State Forest. This spot marks the corner of our lease, the adjacent state forest, and privately owned property. Looking over the story post, you can see a grouping of lovely tall straight pine trees. Canariensis is their scientific name, and they were a trial pine tree that didn't quite make the grade for pine plantations in WA. Can you see the sap coming through the bark at various points? They still bear the scars of a fire that burned some time ago. To the right of these pines is a glimpse into State Forest Number 1. As you can see, there's a distinct lack of tuart trees in this area, and the park-like forest that Captain Bunbury described in his journal is nowhere to be seen. The Wadandi people once managed this forest with regular low, slow and cool burns of the forest floor. This process cleansed the soil, eradicating it of the bacteria and ants that destroyed the tuart seeds, and the fire provided the necessary ash bed for the tuart seed to thrive. At the time, the abundance of tuart trees provided shelter for the animals who were not under threat by this slow-moving fire. Unfortunately, now the peppermint tree and the arum lily has established a significant foothold in the state forest. These conditions prevent even the toughest of seeds from striking. Our volunteers and local schoolchildren have planted over 100,000 tuart seedlings in the years between 2018 and 2024. But we've only scratched the surface of what's required to ensure this forest survives and thrives. We need help and would welcome your donation of time or money. As you change direction with the path, you can see another type of pine tree on your right, a Corsica pine. Look high up in the branches and you might notice a mass that resembles a tumour of some kind. We don't know what it is. It doesn't seem to have affected the tree, though. All of these pines, and more, were planted by the nurserymen, possibly as far back as 1910. Ludlow River Delta. You're now standing in the old Ludlow River Delta. Originally, the Ludlow River would have made its way through here and run towards the large Wanneroo estuary that existed between here and the ocean. But back in the 1930s, the Public Works Department rerouted the Ludlow River to create more farming areas for cattle and potatoes. You'll be able to see the man-made banks of the river up ahead soon. Continue to walk through the grove of flooded gums ahead of you until you reach the next story post. Rootstock Nursery. Spreading out over approximately 1 to 2 acres before you was once a large nursery where the rootstock of the Pinaster and Radiata pine trees were nurtured. The nurserymen would raise the pine seedlings in the ground here for about 8 months. Then in August, they were dug up and taken out to the plantation area for planting. Created in 1916 and closed in 1950, the rootstock nursery area has since been left to nature. You can still see the remnants of the experimental plantings of the various pine trees and eucalypt trees throughout the area. There are Sydney bluegums, Mary, Carrie, spotted gum, slash pine, pinaster and radiata pine scattered throughout the space. The large urn-shaped honky nuts you may see dotted on the ground around you are the seed pods of the Mary tree. Known for its distinctive grain and gorgeous honey-turned timber, the Mary honky nuts provide an essential food source for the native wildlife. In 1916, you would have seen along the edge of this path three wooden, one-roomed huts, the homes for the nurserymen. They really didn't have far to walk to work, no chance of being late either. But each hut was simple digs with a bed, kerosene lanterns, a few cooking implements, and an open fireplace at one end. The men who lived and worked here were happy lads, full of life and cheeky business. Can you imagine living here in a little wooden hut smaller than your average-sized bedroom? Ludlow River. Behind you are the high man-made banks of the Ludlow River that was redirected by the PWD back in the 1930s. In front of this story post, you may see the remnants of the old fence that bordered the northern boundary of the original rootstock nursery. It's pretty here, isn't it? Take a look along the walk trail as it runs up beside the river. The scenery seems idyllic, as the path is framed by the peppy trees that filter the light through their flowing branches and leaves. Then beyond, you can see a mix of a variety of tall timbers, eucalypts and conifers, all seeming to exist harmoniously. Sadly, you have to look hard to find a tuart tree here. Now, I invite you to walk slowly to the next story post while I share a true crime story with you. Back in 1866, Thomas, Tommy Larkin, owned the land just on the other side of the Ludlow River from where you are now. Thomas was one of six children, and his life prior to settling here at Ludlow could only be described as tumultuous. Here's some of the story. Thomas's mum, Bridget Larkin, was widowed when her husband and the father of Tommy died in Bunbury. Life was hard for a single mum of six children, but Bridget was young and determined not to be single for too long. She met and married John Herford in 1851 and promptly moved herself and her children from Bunbury to his farm holdings in Vass. At the age of 65, John was almost twice the age of Bridget and considered wealthy, with savings of some £2,000 and two land holdings, a good catch for any lady. But the relationship was not a happy one, and it's said that Bridget was not kind to her husband, John. In fact, John told one of his friends that Bridget had knocked out some of his teeth in an argument. On the evening of April the 8th, 1855, John, bedridden with a cold, was found dead in his bed. An inquest was held, and a doctor initially found that his death was of natural causes. But later that month, a labourer named Enoch Dodd confessed to another farm labourer, Philip Dixon, that he had murdered John Herford. It turns out that Dixon also had something to confess. He, under the influence of Bridget, had forged John's will in favour of Bridget. Dodd shared with Dixon that Bridget had plied him with alcohol and then stood over him while he strangled John Herford to make sure he was dead. Nasty. The two accomplices could not live with the guilt and confessed the murder and the forgery to the authorities. Needless to say, Dixon, Dodd and Bridget Larkin were arrested. Both Enoch Dodd and Bridget Larkin were sentenced to hanging for their part in the murder. Bridget felt confident that because she was a woman, she would not be taken to the gallows. But on the 15th of October, 1855, Bridget Larkin was the first woman to be hanged in Western Australia. It's believed that Thomas was in his late teens at the time, a young man with a heavy burden to bear. Ludlow Workshop. In this corner of the forestry compound, you can see the remnants of fruit trees in front of you and behind the workshop to the right. It's thought they were planted either by the early settlers or the caretakers of the forestry schools to provide the forestry cadets with fresh fruit. Remarkably, they're still producing mulberries and figs until this day, over 100 years later. To the right, and in the very back corner of the compound, is the Ludlow Workshop building. It was built in 1968. The building was quite unique for its time. It has a timber-constructed, bowstring roof truss system that was considered a showpiece and a wonderful example of the engineering strength of timber. The forestry mechanics proudly worked on the forestry vehicles in this expansive and relatively modern building. Behind you is a better view of the Ludlow River. In the 1800s and early 1900s, it was an important water source for the native animals and a place to swim and cool off for the local people. Now, like many little rivers in the district, it's generally bone dry in summer and doesn't reach the flow levels it once did in peak season. Storeroom and workshop. Looking through the fence, you can see a building directly in front of you. This storeroom was built back in the 1970s to house the plans, records, and some of the servicing equipment for the Sunclans Pine Plantation project. Now we enjoy delicious morning teas and host small gatherings in this practical space. According to early sketches of the site layout, this building stands approximately where the original stables and surrounding horse paddocks would have been. The old weathered building to the left of the store is the original workshop and garage. Built in the 1950s, it's a wonderful example of hewn or hand-shaped timber. Restored in 2023, its unique interior transforms for small events, and the large garage doors on the other side now open up like a deep breath, welcoming the outside into this beautiful historic space. When the site is open, please take a wander through. Across the river from here is Les Warner's hut. Built in the 1940s, it was a single man's quarters, similar to the ones that lined the path near the rootstock nursery. The little hut expanded over time to include three rooms, a bedroom, a kitchen, and a small lounge room. But no mod cons were to be had on the inside. All the ablutions, including the bathroom, toilet, and laundry, were outside of the house. Les was originally employed as the billy boy for the early pine planting crews. At 10 o'clock every morning, he made sure the billy was on the boil so the men could enjoy their morning tea, smoko, and bush yarns over a good cup of tea. In later years, he became a machine operator and general jack-of-all-trades. Les was one of the first residents of Ludlow and then one of the last to leave in the late 1990s. He lived alone in his little hut for about 50 years. Sawmill and sheds. The buildings in front of you essentially make up the milling section of the Ludlow Sawmill. Located closest to Ludlow North Road is the first sawmill building, and it was constructed in the 1930s to mill the Ludlow Plantation pine thinnings. This building was expanded in the 1950s to cater for additional saw benches and machinery to cut much bigger logs. The building with the sawtooth-shaped roof was the timber storage shed. After the logs were cut into rough sawn planks, they would be transported by hand to this open storage shed and left under cover for many months to dry out. And finally, to the right is the planer mill, where the dried timber was taken from the drying shed to be planed and moulded into usable smooth boards. As you can imagine, this area was extremely noisy and dangerous and dirty. In the open space between these buildings and about 20 paces in front of you was the very large round steel teepee burner, a 15-metre tall conical-shaped construction. It was like one humongous fireplace that served the purpose of burning the sawdust and offcuts of timber from the sawmills and the planer shed. Described by some of the children who resided there as a giant Dalek. You may remember the Daleks from Doctor Who? It had a wide open mouth that permanently breathed fire and a cap on top that constantly spewed out smoke. It was the scariest part of the whole settlement for the children of Ludlow. If the site is open, please walk through and around the buildings. You'll see information signs on each building. They provide more detail of its age and purpose. Behind you, and closer to the Ludlow Bridge, is the second of the original toilet blocks built for the forestry workers. Ludlow Bridge itself has quite a history and predates the forestry settlement. As you follow the path across the Ludlow North Road, please stop and be careful crossing the road. School and schoolhouse. In the mid-1800s, the district was abuzz with new families trying to carve out a life and living there. The parcel of land you're standing on now was then allocated to the Education Department. Just in front of this story post, on the open space between here and the road, stood a little wooden rectangular schoolhouse. The numbers of schoolchildren attending the school here were not high, so there was only one classroom and one teacher. A simple structure clad in wood of the style similar to the schoolmaster's house you can see next door, the children were sheltered in summer and warmed by an open fireplace in winter. Apart from the forestry school for the mature forestry students, there were two small schools at Ludlow that were open for children at different periods of time. The one that stood on this site offered a place for education from 1926 to 1948. Many local children have happy memories of schooling here. Daphne Froome recounts a time during World War II when her teacher, Mr. Kemp, had the older boys build a bomb shelter by the river. Mr. Kemp ensured the little underground structure was sturdy by lining it with wood, and Daphne recalls doing regular drills where she and her friends would quickly and orderly make their way to the shelter and assemble inside. War was not taken lightly. And to make sure they were absolutely ready for an invasion, the locals decided that the tram line, which carried the timber logs across the Ludlow River, needed to go. They feared the enemy could use this bridge to gain easy access to the southwest, so they needed to destroy it and minimize the access points across the river. War times called for extreme measures. The wooden house you see to the left of this space was the original schoolteacher's home, and it lovingly housed several schoolteachers and their family whilst the school was open. Small at first, the schoolteacher's house has been expanded over time to include a bathroom and more bedrooms. When it first arrived here in 1926, it was nothing more than a small two-roomed building with no power, no running water. Mrs. Cameron, the teacher's wife at the time, expressed her dire concerns in a letter to the Education Department. She writes, "Things are in a very bad state under the present conditions. We have nowhere to wash, unless we stand out the back in 6 inches of dust with a dish fixed up with wooden planks. There's no water at either the quarters or the school. My husband has to carry what we use in kerosene tins on his shoulders from a well at the forestry farm." Well, it seems the Education Department ignored Mrs. Cameron's letter in early 1926. But after receiving another letter, this time from Mr. Cameron, a bathroom and washhouse was erected on the site some 6 months after they moved in. After the school closed in 1948, the Forest Department acquired the old teachers' quarters, and it then became a home for many forestry families. Tragically, one of these families experienced a great loss in their life at Ludlow. In the late 1970s, Russell Tate and his family lived in the old schoolhouse. Russell was dedicated and an experienced forester who could turn his hand to many of the jobs required to manage the forest and plantations. One of those skilled jobs was tree felling. Unfortunately, On one fateful day, Russell was killed on the job by a falling tree. A very sad day for the Tate family and for the forestry community. Houses. You're now positioned between the Ludlow River and the few houses that were the most recent additions to the forestry site. Noticeably different to the majority of houses at Ludlow, they have clay-tiled roofs and narrower, painted and chamfered pineboard cladding. The house on the corner, two up from the schoolhouse, was built in the 1950s, and the other two in the 1960s. These homes were where the senior officers and forestry managers lived. Consisting of three bedrooms, a kitchen, lounge and inside bathroom, they were considered progressive for the settlement. There were originally two more homes of the same style to the east end closer to the main road, but they were moved into Busselton in the early 1970s to make way for the extension of Tewart Drive that now sweeps past Ludlow to join up with the Bussell Highway. One of the Donnelly girls who lived in the light blue house on the end recalls, "Ludlow was a magical place to live. It was home to about 18 families. That meant there were always kids to play with. Our days were filled with exploring the forest, bike riding, and heading for the beach with friends. Adventurous and carefree, we roamed and played until we saw the sun beginning to disappear behind the treetops. Then we knew we had to head home for dinner. It was a kid's dream, and possibly a parent's ounce of worry. But everybody knew everyone in this little community, and we all looked out for one another." School bus shelter. Built in the 1960s, this little structure was the local school bus stop. It did the trick keeping the kids dry in winter as they waited for the school bus to Busselton. District office. The hub of the settlement in those days was the district office, the building where you downloaded the walk trail guide. It was constructed in two parts. The first, built in the early 1920s, is delineated by Jarrah floorboards. It was the office space for the forester in charge and a place to store the forestry management records. In 1957, the room at the western end was added to the district office. Its Tewart floor with pine dado rail and panelling are a nod to the timbers of the district. This additional space was created to cater for more staff and to house the forest maps. The small room off the veranda is thought to have been completed at a similar time, and it was known as the radio room, a vital space for the important communications equipment that connected all the forestry settlements and enabled quicker responses to fire threats in the southwest. In its heyday, the district office housed several officers, a secretary, and the all-important paymaster. On payday, the paymaster would diligently count out the cash that was held in the large safe within the district office, and then fill the little yellow pay envelopes with the appropriate amounts of cash for each employee. By 4 p.m. that day, he would open the window on the front of the district office to be greeted by a very long line of foresters' wives who'd come to collect their husbands' pay for safekeeping. Restored in 2022, this building, along with the original toilet block on the opposite side of the car park, were the first buildings at the Ludlow Mill and Settlement to be restored by our group. You've now almost completed our short walk trail tour, and we've only just touched on the surface of the remarkable history of Ludlow. We hope you enjoyed it. The District Office Discovery Centre offers more on our diverse history, as does our webpage, www.ludlowtewartforest.org.au. Please take a look through both and keep in touch. We're still collecting and collating stories, photos and the history of Ludlow. So if you've anything to share, we will gratefully receive it. See you again soon. We appreciate your support.